Welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we bring you the joys of what I like to call digital cartography, and we talk a little bit about our gaming in our childhood. Again, welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and joining me is Zach. Mark, unfortunately, had some other commitments that he couldn't break, so we are doing it minus one this week. We were minus one last time.
Yeah, we have had trouble getting, I don't want to say getting going in the new year, but it's just like most of America, I think we've all been snowed in at some point, or the weather, or something. You
know? I don't know. The Tomb Show guy, I forget his name. I can see his Twitter account.
Oh, Jeff?
Jeff, yes, there we go.
Yeah, Jeff.
God,
yeah.
I'm just horrible today. Apparently, he was reporting on Twitter just that he wasn't able to do his episode recording today either.
So, but bear with us, guys. We're getting it straightened out. We're here. And we'll talk some gaming.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing too is that Mark is almost finished with his D&D encounters that he's been running, so that's kind of affected our recording schedule too.
Yeah, and it's pretty terrible, but it's also made me hate D&D encounters because, you know, it's messing with our podcast. So I'm just going to take it out on Wizards Organized Play. Why not?
Oh, sure, you do that. While you're seething in the corner, I think we should do a little news. What do you think?
Sounds good.
Well, we actually have a little bit of news this week, which I'm happy to say, because I think last time it was just a little shy. Kind of something that I thought was pretty good from a perspective, even though I'm currently probably not going to Gen Con 2011, is, well, of course, Gen Con 2011, the pre-registration is open. You can actually, I think you can even start registering events, too, if I read that right. It's always
pretty cool.
Yeah, so if you do plan on going to Gen Con, the pre-registration cost is $68 for the four-day pass, and then I think if you actually go to register while you're there, it's like 78, so you save like 10 bucks.
It is going to be really strange if neither one of us goes to Gen Con this year, but that's what it's looking like.
Well, so. I know. Well, Mark isn't either because, well, he's going to be a father for a second time, so you'll have his wife is. Yeah, it's really close, and it's like, well, I can understand that. So, but yeah, I unfortunately, it's just last year kicked my ass in terms of finances, and I think everyone felt that financial pinch. And we're still recovering. I think everyone's recovering. It's a shame, though.
I think so.
It's a shame, though, because, you know, as you know, the convention hall has been revamped, and it's actually going to be larger, at least in terms of, like, the vendor area, vendor booths.
Right, which will be nice. I mean, there was a lot of space before, but I think it's going to be pretty.
I think the actual official space, if they used it all, would be, like, double or something like that. It's ridiculous.
That's really cool.
So, because I remember looking at something, so that's kind of cool. Our friend Michael has finished editing another gentleman's material called Resolute Adventure and Genius. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of an offshoot of the. It's kind of
Warrior Rogue Mage.
Yeah, it's what is he called? He's calling it the Worm System, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it uses the Worm System, but it's a kind of a pulp adventure kind of game. And that's actually, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So you can get that off basically RPG Now, Drive Through RPG, you know, same place basically. So what actually interested me, though, was your buddies over at Rogue Games. Did you see that news?
Yes. Yeah, pretty neat.
Yeah, they're actually going to license the 12 Degree system out to Battlefield Press. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think so. That's a system that the first time I looked at it, it really didn't do a lot for me. But obviously with Thousand Suns and Shadow Sword and Spell, it really, really grew on me very quickly. It's a very simple system
One of these days I am going to have to get Colonial Gothic, though, because that that just kind of interests me in a weird way. It's like I've always wanted to actually, and I've never succeeded in doing it, but I've always wanted to run a D&D game that was kind of that whole, you're in the new world era kind of thing. So, but that's just me.
I think it's Colonial Gothic is just a really, for a history buff, it's absolutely golden. It's good stuff. Best thing to say about it.
So that's really cool. Actually, another piece of Gen Con news. Apparently, on Twitter, Chaosium actually announced that they're actually going to have their own booth at Gen Con 2011.
Well, they're making me regret not going.
I know. It's just, honestly, trust me, I've actually tried to convince a couple of my friends to go, to actually take the 2-day road trip to Indianapolis, and then the two-day road trip back to go, but so far no solid bites on that. Because I'd drive it. I have no qualms on driving it. It's just that I would need someone to help me drive a little bit of that.
Oh sure.
So, but because it would actually, I figured it out. It would actually be, if I had a couple of guys going, it'd be so much cheaper than doing anything else, but that doesn't look good either. So, actually, we got one more drive-through RPG item, Cubicle 7. Apparently, until I think it's February 7th or something, is actually having a sale on their core rulebooks through, through drive-through RPG. $11. So, if you wanted to look at the Doctor Who rule books and didn't want to actually buy the box set, you could actually spend $11 for the PDF.
Yeah. Cubicle 7, that also goes for Star Blazer Adventures, doesn't it, as well? Or
it's just, they just said it's just Cubicle 7.
That's what I'm saying, but that's, yeah, I guess that is too.
And then they have a lot of their supplements for like $5 and $7.
Nice deal.
So that's kind of nice. If you actually were thinking of picking up some Cubicle 7 PDFs, go out there and pick them up now while they're a little bit cheaper. Apparently, they were inspired by the New Year $11 sale that they had earlier, that we reported last time that there were only a few days left on. This time we have a little more leeway. We're going to have about a week, so that's happy. And then our buddy over at 66 Fireball, he's actually releasing his rule system under a Creative Commons license. It's a modified Creative Commons license. It has some restrictions.
I didn't look at the particulars on it.
Well, it's a Creative Commons, but basically it means that you have to, he's just requiring that you say that, yes, give ownership to the author who wrote the original rules kind of thing. Saying if you use that rule system and then you can't use his logo that he has for his thing, you can say you're compatible on your product. And then the other requirement is that if you produce, you can publish your own game with using a rule set, but you have to allow people to basically do the same thing that he's giving you the right to do, which is fairly common Creative Commons kind of thing. Which is good. So the last one is kind of the only one that's kind of a little weird. We talked about this a year ago. You remember about a year ago where we reported about the prison taking away the D&D material from the prisoners?
Yes, I do.
Well, apparently he went to court way in September, and the Seventh Circuit Court, he had an appeal, and the Seventh Circuit Court, I think that's correct. You can read more in the link that I provided. Decided that the prison had the right to do that if they thought it was a threat to, prison security. So,
well, I guess it is what it is, right?
Yeah, but, I'm kind of the opinion, unfortunately, that, unfortunately, it's a prison. The guy that was bringing it up, he was trying to say that his Second Amendment rights were being violated. by not having access to the material. And there is kind of a case for that, except for the fact that, unfortunately, this is just my opinion. I'm not a lawyer. The concept of being in prison is that you've actually lost your rights to, you know, so you do kind of we have a weird, the legal system in our country is a little weird, but you know, it's like you have some rights, but you don't get all your rights. So, but one thing is true. Our buddy over at The Escapist, he had a very good point. And out of his entire blog, it was the only thing that I thought was a valid point, is that people who decide that they don't like D&D and want it out of like some other places, like a library or a school or something, can possibly use this court case as a basis for a reason not to allow it.
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, but here's
the thing. Like all court cases, you need more than one ruling. You have to have a history of it before it becomes fact. But it's an interesting viewpoint on it. So we're going to have his blog and our show notes, a link to his in the show notes as well. So you can read all about it and enjoy, I suppose. Well, you want to get to it, or do you have anything else you want to add?
I did have the one bit on Firehawk Games, which is actually coming from Tim Duggar, who people will probably know from his work when he was at Iron Crown for doing HARP, Rollmaster SS, or Rollmaster FRP, and some work on Rollmaster Classic. He's involved with a small company now called Firehawk Games, and they've just released their first RPG, Novus, in an open beta format. It is available on RPG Now. It's a 2d10 rollover target number system incorporating exploding dice. So there's a little bit of that open-ended Rollmaster factor, I guess, at work. But there's a deluxe version for $5, and there's an unbookmarked, very basic version that is free to download over there. So if folks want to check that out, see what it's up. I really haven't gotten into reading it yet, but I've kind of gone over the blurb, I guess, on it, and I've added it to the pile. So,
yeah, unfortunately, I still haven't gone through the Haiti bundle.
Oh man, I never will get through all of the Haiti. Man, I did my best, but I got close. I think at least I looked at stuff. But
yeah, I looked at some stuff, and I actually have some stuff and some stuff I'll never use. So there you go. Well, why don't we go ahead and get into our first topic for tonight, which, by the way, is something I kind of like to talk about a little bit here and there, because, well, I have a master's degree in geographic information science. So, yes, cartography. Cartography is kind of my bitch sometimes. And when I mean bitch, I mean that I bitch about it a lot. You know, I mean, you've heard me talk. I mean, I've always...
We've had discussions.
I mean, I don't know how many times I've sat down and said, hey, you know what? I really think that most of the cartography that I see in most game products is more artwork than useful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and don't get me wrong. I mean, there's reasons to have both. But, you know, I don't know how many times I've actually saw a map and said, wow, that's a great map, that's even usable. Case in point, speaking of Rollmaster, is let's go to MERP, and the MERP maps were, let's face it, gorgeous.
Pete Fenlon, yes. Oh, just amazing work.
You know, and they were usable, and they weren't like, I mean, it's weird. It's like one of the few times, you know, it was in many ways it was a piece of art, but on the other hand, it was still a very usable product. And what I find in a lot of times nowadays is that it's more art than usable product. And I find it, and I don't know if that's because of the high gloss factor that we're starting to have in a lot of our products.
Yeah, could be.
You know, I mean, I love Paizo for their products, generally speaking. But some of the products, like some of their adventure paths, some of the maps, I had a really hard time using. And it really infuriated me. So it's like, okay, this is a map that I really can't use, and I basically had to write off a whole section of the map just because I couldn't use it, and I just kind of had to make it. Well, it was a sea cavern, and the problem is that they had different altitudes different locations were at different altitudes, and there was no way to tell that on the map. If you actually read the description text, you had to piece it together from the description text.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it wasn't clear what was higher than another piece. So it's like, okay, I kind of winged it when I did that.
Well, you know, I think it's possible to get too stylized with maps.
So,
and, you know, part of the problem is that, like you say, we've kind of geared in large part, or part of the hobby has, towards these high gloss production values. And that doesn't mean you can't have a high-functioning, glossy, purdy map, you know. But it does seem to be sometimes that gets in the way.
Right.
Personally, I like my old-school hex maps. And
right.
I like the work that Rob Conley does. And it's, hey, I use it, the Greyhawk hex map.
Well, let's face it, we both enjoy Hexographer a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Hexographer's excellent if you want to make something usable in an RPG context that can still, you know, has that classic look to it. So any chance we get to plug Hexographer, by all means.
And, of course, he has Dungeonographer, too, which is
right.
Fantastic. However, those are – the funny thing is I was actually talking about ways – I actually kind of wanted to talk about ways to make maps. And generally speaking, there's – really, there's actually a few different ways. I mean, obviously, you know, especially in the digital arena is what I was kind of thinking about specifically, is because, you know, we all do hand-drawn maps, and I'm, you know, I've done everything from draw a quick sketch on a napkin to, you know, count squares. It's like, I know I have to count the number of squares because this room, you know, I've done traveler deck plans, and, you know, it's like, okay, I have this much tonnage, I should have these number of squares per ton, and you know, so you're actually trying to draw out an actual ship, and you're trying to figure out, well, it's kind of a saucer shape or, you know, an oval shape, so you kind of rough, you know, what a pain in the ass, by the way. So basically, you know, the funny thing about doing it digitally is you don't have that many options. You have a lot of options, but they really fall into some really broad categories. I mean, first off, let's face it, you have just basic graphic programs, and we're talking things like Photoshop, GIMP. I'll say it. Just Microsoft Paint.
I've done that. Yeah.
You know, there's the realm of what I kind of like to call tile mappers. You know, basically what they do is they give you pre-made graphics that you can just like. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a stamp. You just stamp them together, and there's your map, which. Nothing wrong with that, by the way. Some of the better looking maps that you can produce really easily are of that type, because you just have these tiles that you can just go, oof, here, I'm going to stick these together and I'm done. Dungeony is kind of like that, if memory serves me. It's been a while since I've tried to use that piece of software. And then, of course, there is what I'm going to call the CAD-based mapping. And, of course, the most prevalent one in that category is kind of Campaign Cartographer. So... And, you know, one of the best mapping resources for anyone who's an aspiring mapper of any type is, of course, the forum, the Cartographer's Guild. And I'll have a link in the show notes to that. And, you know, you go there and everyone will espouse the way that they make maps. It's like, no, you need to be using Campaign Cartographer. No. You know, but I mean, most of them are really nice about it. But generally speaking, it's like there is no one way to do good maps. I've heard people, you know, I'll do it in Campaign Cartographer and then I'll export it and bring it into Photoshop and tighten it up and do this, and, you know, you're just like, wow, that's, you know. And then some people say, well, I always use GIMP, and somebody goes, no, why would you use GIMP? You should be using, you know, Inkscape or whatever. It is Inkscape, right? Yeah, it's Inkscape, which is their, you know, vector drawing program. So, you know, just like, wow, that is a lot of work. You know, and trust me, I've tried it. And for my personal bitch is that, unfortunately, I've done a lot of GIS work. And in the GIS universe, the primary package for GIS work, per se, at least for most people, when they hear GIS, they think of something called ArcView or ArcGIS.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some pretty, it has mapping capabilities. Because obviously you use maps, but of course map, it's always map data with spatial related data to it. So you mm-hmm. can draw a polygon and associate a whole bunch of database data with it.
Oh, okay.
So the data is spatially aware is what it boils down to. So it's like, you know, you could have a map with a layer, and you could draw all the fauna, you know, draw fauna and polygons for different fauna, and then assign attributes for that fauna. And then you could do another layer for animals and so on and so forth. Well, the problem is that in that software, it's really easy to draw, like have a really huge map at a really large uh-huh. scale, and then say, you know what, I just want to take this slice of this map and then do something with it. You can do that real easy in a GIS program. You can't do that so much in these other programs. Plus, here's a funky thing about the GIS programs. And I dare say I don't know very many other mapping softwares that can. You put symbols on the maps.
Mm-hmm.
They actually maintain proper. They actually render to the proper scale. So if you set it at a certain scale, when you zoom in, it's still that scale. In other words, it actually the size of the icons or the symbols don't change no matter what map scale you are. So they stay the same. Does that make sense? They're a constant size.
Yeah, I think so. That's...
Because you know a lot of times like on some of the like. Some of the maps you go in, especially like Campaign Cartographer is a little bit like this. You could zoom into a section, and whatever symbol's there has blown up to really huge on your screen. So sometimes you know those are little nitpicky things. So that's why a lot of these softwares just kind of make me mad. Now, granted, I'm not going to advise someone to go out and spend you know the $1,000+ just to use ArcGIS. It's like you know that's like using. I don't know, a chainsaw is a hammer or something. You know, it's ridiculous. Yeah. Hi, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to build your house. I'm just going to use nothing but this chainsaw. It's like, okay, yeah, I don't think I want you as my contractor. So, you know, or using a pickaxe to dig a tunnel to China. You know, that kind of thing. So, it's just one of those things. I just don't know. I want to do digital maps, and I've kind of picked up the thing that, hey, you know, I want to do it again. And I've kind of decided that, unfortunately, even with everything I hate about the artistic aspect of maps, that can be mm-hmm. too artistic, I've kind of gone back right. to the viewpoint that, you know, using something like GIMP or even Photoshop is probably a little better than using Campaign Cartographer. I think for most people, especially people that don't have interest in the CAD, you know, or CAD-like syntax for things, they're going to find it a lot more familiar. It's going to be a lot easier for them to do things, I think, in the end.
You know what's strange? Its adherents really preach it up, but I had a horrible time with the learning curve on Campaign Cartographer. And it might be just because I'm a moron when it comes to that stuff, but I really did not have an easy time with it. I had an easier time with Fractal Mapper than I did Campaign Cartographer.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it is there's the CAD background to Campaign Cartographer, which is good and bad. I mean, I've tried to use mm-hmm. other CAD programs for doing mapping for years. So, and it's not like I'm a complete alien when it comes to using a CAD program. The problem is that it just it has become easier, but it still is just like it seems like wow, it's like I can hand draw this faster and do a much better job than I ever can do in Campaign Cartographer. And I know there's people that are going like, wait, are you talking about I spent, you know, 2 hours and I produced a map that looks so fantastic. It's like great. If that's what you're good at, use it.
Yeah.
So but no, I mean I think for most of us, I think, you know, using an actual drawing program makes a little bit more sense. And especially since, I'm not going to lie, I actually have a small drawing tablet. You know, it's a Wacom, mm-hmm. I think, bamboo little tablet. I mean, it's not, the resolution on it's not super great technically, but it's like, okay, you know, I have a stylus, I can use my drawing pad, I can actually draw on that and it gets represented on the screen. It's like, that's perfect. That's exactly what I need to, you know, I mean, it's an artist tool, effectively. And
right.
It's like, well, that makes sense because I want to use an artist tool. And here's the funny thing, especially what I found out about GIMP, especially the latest versions of GIMP, is there's a lot of things in like Photoshop and in GIMP. There are brushes, and basically that's what you use to paint with. You have different brush types. Well, the funny thing is that in many ways the brushes are almost symbols. You can almost think of them as a symbol store. And there are a lot of free brushes out there for a whole crap load of things. You know, so it's like, and GIMP will actually read the Photoshop brushes now. Ever since, I think, like 2.5, 2.6 or something like that. It will actually read them. So it's like, there's all these Photoshop brushes out there that people have used. And it's like, wow. And I mean, I found stuff for that I think would look really cool on a map and wouldn't ruin the functionality of the map. Things like, you know, magic circles and stuff. And it's like, wow, that's kind of cool. I wouldn't have to draw that if I wanted to just put one on my map and use it, you know, as part of the map representation. So, I don't know. I'm heading towards actually playing with using GIMP a lot. And it actually has some functions that I don't think it used to have, because when I read through the Cartographers Guild walkthroughs for certain things, one guy was talking about, well, this is what you should do to put a grid on your map. And what I found out is that there's actually a grid render function in GIMP where it will just go like, okay, you go through the little filters, you select the render, and then there's grid, and then you input your parameters, and then it overlays a grid right on top of your image, whatever you've done. So it's like, depending on how you wanted to draw it, you could either do that first or do that last or whatever. And I'm like, okay, I like that. We'll go with that. So that's kind of it. It's just kind of weird. It's like I've always wanted to use a computer to do my drawings, you know, to do my maps, but I've never had a good way of doing that. And I think the other thing, too, is I was always like, there's no good way to do revisions of maps either. And now that I've done a lot more, I mean, this was way back when, and now that I've done a lot of programming, I'm thinking, well, geez, you know, all I have to do is use the same methodology that I do when I do code work, which is basically use a code repository, but use it for storing my maps instead, so I can have the different revisions of the maps in my store. So, well, that's really it. It's just, I'm just running at the mouth.
Well, it's a subject you're very passionate about, so, you know, we've definitely discussed it before. I know cartography is pretty high on your list, so.
Yeah, and, you know, it just sucks so bad because it's like I can't really do fantasy maps worth a damn.
Well, join the club. I had to have Rob Conley do my one for me last year, which came out really well because Rob's very talented. But on my own, you know, it's a labor of love, but I guess it doesn't make it good from any kind of objective point of view. Right. But I like him.
All right. Well, you know, funny thing is we've been talking about a lot of things, and we've actually been talking about some stuff in the news, and we're both, I would consider us both sort of longtime gamers. So, sure. And it's, well, let's face it, it's just kind of near and dear to our hearts, otherwise we've been doing this podcast. But you kind of wanted to talk about gaming in our childhoods, I think, was your choice of a topic?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to talk about the perception of certain games we had in our childhood. And one of the interesting things for me is we all come from this different gaming background. Some of us started with D&D, some of us started with Rollmaster, some of us started with Traveller, or in my case, Palladium Fantasy and Rifts, and Traveller soon after.
always Traveller.
There's always Traveller. But as I became aware that there were other groups and other systems out there, I sort of got these perceptions of those groups, right or wrong. Generally wrong, but there you go. And it's interesting because even back then, I think some of those childhood biases have endured into our adulthood, into our adult gaming. For example, I mean, even back then, as a Rifts player, I was considered a power-hungry munchkin I would tell the RuneQuest guys that I played Rifts, and you would get this eye-rolling look, you know, and Ninja Turtles was the same way. It was this condescension, this almost sympathy in a way, like, oh, well, you don't know any better, you know, and maybe you'll graduate to RuneQuest. I think in my encounters with other gamers back then, there was very much, just like there is online today, a territorialism.
Oh, I agree with that.
That came with the game, you know, and those of us who played Rifts, you know, until I played Rules Cyclopedia D&D, which just, you know, was just awesome, and still the best single volume rule set I think ever. You know, we had this idea of D&D is so limited. You know, they don't even get rune weapons, or they don't even get this, or you know. And I'm sure the D&D guys thought we were nuts playing with the dog boys and the juicers and the psyker or the
bursters. I mean, the Palladium Sister in general was always viewed as kind of offbeat. I mean, even when it was something that a lot of gamers that I knew liked, like Robotech. I don't know anyone that didn't like watching Robotech as a kid, at least when I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, and even playing that, they were like, yeah, really? Yeah. I don't know.
And a Traveler, you know, one of my friends' dads actually taught us that. And of course, his buddies and everything had, you know, they owned entire solar systems at that point. And so to us, that was a more in-depth older gentleman's game, I guess you'd call it, you know, written these strange notations on ancient index cards thrown together in this black box. and it was very intriguing to us for that reason, you know, and we made dozens of Traveler characters. But, oh, this guy's crap. Oh, this guy's done after two terms. Oh, this guy's a 42-year-old officer and he's got his own ship. All right, you know. And I think to us, Traveler was much more a mature, refined, you know, older gentleman's game.
Which is kind of funny when you actually read the classic rules today, because you're going like, really? That's all there is to them?
Yeah, you know, but to us, it was new and exciting. And, you know, hey, none of us had ever had a character die in Care Gen before.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
there was something exciting about having, you know, signing up for the Marines or the Navy and seeing what happened.
I think a lot of it, especially for me when I was growing up for Traveler, was the fact that Traveler was the first game that I ever played that actually had skills. You know, because D&D, when I played D&D, they didn't have skills. You're just like, okay, you have some attributes, you have some hit points, and depending, you may have some abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a spellcaster, you might have some spells, and there you go, that's it.
I think that's a good point.
Yeah.
And, you know,
And then, of course, you didn't really get a choice of skills. You rolled it, and it's like, you get gun combat. What combat do you want?
I think the randomness of it is something that I certainly found intriguing. And something that would carry over into a game that may not seem that related, but Rollmaster. When you start, you know, when you start getting into that and seeing the random charts and everything, that's just an unending book. That's like the never-ending story.
I remember playing Rollmaster, and I think for people who were into Rollmaster, you were just like, wow, this system has it all. This has skills. This allows me to make my character. You know, exactly. I can spend character points. You know, and it, you know, you're like, wow, it has a really complex healing system, and wow, there's all these weird herbs that I can find that can actually do things.
I still use those herb charts.
So much fun. Well, you know, and the funny thing is, and everyone else is like, dude, you have to use a calculator. You know, that's always the outside perception. It's like, dude, you have to use a calculator to find out if you actually do anything. Screw that. You know. I mean, because I remember that. It's like you're sitting there, okay, I have a plus 97 OB, and then I rolled a 67, and his DB is 36.
Yeah.
And let me cross-reference it to the proper AT.
Yeah. And, you know, to be uninitiated, that was like cross-eyed talk there. But.
And then, oh, let's not forget, let's do an 11B critical, 11D crush or something.
Oh, man, love those D crits. I think a lot of times that from when we were younger, those biases and those perceptions carry over even today. You know, I've been playing with OpenQuest a lot lately, and the folks involved with that are super friendly and super, you know, super nice about it, especially since I don't have a big RuneQuest background. But, you know, growing up, I always thought those guys were a little standoffish. They were playing this game from England, you know, and it was just very very superior, and everything. They had this self-assurance that their rules were superior to anything out there.
Yeah, well, you know, RuneQuest. The only edition of RuneQuest that I own and that I actually played was the release from Avalon Hill.
The third edition, or the...
I don't know what they consider that.
Right.
And I just remember that, you know, so I didn't know anything about the whole Glorantha setting, for one, because that wasn't even included in that rulebook. But I remember when I picked it up, I don't know how I got introduced to it, but I was looking through the rules, and it's like, you know, one of the races that was in the monster book or whatever it was that you could actually have for player characters was Duck. And I'm like, yeah, really? Right? Are you sure?
Yeah. And, you know, the Ducks are still a huge point of contention for people now. You know, some people think that they're, you know, a fun part of that whole setting, and other people do not.
It definitely is a classic part of the system. And actually, I think in that edition of RuneQuest 2, the elves were technically plants. Is that right? It's been a while since I read the rules.
Oh, man, I'd have to go back.
Which was interesting.
I really do not have a RuneQuest background in any sense. I mean, I talked to the guys who played it, but I mean, it was always kind of just out there. It was never in my groups, you know, and right. You know, we were too busy making mutants and Ninja Turtles with BioE, and I don't regret a minute of it. But
no, I mean, you had fun.
Each their own, of course. So,
but you know, the funny thing is, you know, they have this new version of Gammaworld out, and I remember playing a lot of Gammaworld when I was a kid, growing up, because next to D&D, that was the second game I think that I ever owned. You know, I didn't even own Traveler yet. Traveler, actually, I didn't get it. It's like I played it as a when I was in the sixth grade a couple of times with a friend of mine who was really in. He was a gamer, but was really into Traveler.
Yeah.
But you know, for me, the transition was like D&D, Gammaworld, and Traveler came later. Even though at this point in my life, out of all the games I've ever played, the two games that I have the warmest places in my heart is Traveler and Rolemaster, and I almost won't play either one of them right now because both of them have some rule issues, to say the least. But definitely Gammaworld, and it's kind of funny, though, because Gammaworld actually had a lot of additions that I didn't realize. You know?
Yeah. Oh, it's been through a number of additions, some very good and some with the heart and soul pretty much torn out of them, like the one that...
Because there was an addition... That
was the one Bruce Baugh did that, and I'm sorry, I mean no offense against the gentleman, but that was an atrocious version of Gammaworld. It was a couple years ago, and
I don't know. I was thinking of an edition where it seemed like they tried to half borrow the mechanics from Marvel superheroes.
Man, I'd have to go back. I got to play early Gammaworld, then I looked at that one, the aforementioned one I just mentioned, and then I've seen the most recent WotC one as well. So
right, I haven't tried that one, but it's like I have a couple of editions. I actually have a first edition second printing somewhere.
Oh yeah,
which is really cool. Just because the funny thing about games is that people don't realize that back in the early days, a game could be 86 pages long, and that was not a big deal. You know, I think that's an interesting perception difference between when we were kids and now. Nowadays, we expect, you know, a complete game system to be like 100 pages, 300 pages, 500 pages. You know, we expect this large rule book to be this complete game. And back in the day, you know, if you had like 100 pages, that was a complete game.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, if I had picked up the Paizo, you know, core rulebook when I was in high school, I don't think I could have finished it.
Well, it's an interesting point. Maybe not. I think our tastes, our tolerances, our expectations have probably changed over the years.
You know.
There's no probably about it.
Yeah. Well, actually, did I say high school? I missed when I was a kid, because it's like I started gaming when I was like in the fourth grade. Mm-hmm. The first, I actually tried to play AD&D with my brothers. Was interested in doing it. Couldn't figure out the rules, of course. And ended up actually buying... I didn't buy the red box, but I bought the rule book for the red box because they actually sold it separately. So I got the basic set rule book separately, you know, and that was like, oh, wow, you know, which was great. You know, the funny thing about that is I remember playing that with that, you know, with just first three levels. There you go. And, you know, I mean, that actually lasted quite a while because, you know, you were trying to figure out how to be a game master and they were trying to figure out how to be players.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, a lot of deaths. It got pretty gritty. So, you know, and then, of course, you finally got the expert set, which I think covered up to like 14th level or something bizarre like that. So, and eventually all those sets, you know, because they eventually had the master set and the immortal set or whatever. There was another one. There was like five sets, which eventually became the rule cyclopedia.
Yeah, basic, expert, companion, master, and immortal.
Okay. Yeah, I only got the first. I think I only ever bought the first three rule books, and that was it.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, I think a lot of people just got here and there on those.
But I still remember in the basic set, it's like you have the option of all weapons do a D6, or you can use the random damage for the various things. And you're like, well, why the hell wouldn't you do that? I don't know. I still remember that. It's just like, you know, even today, you know, I played D&D so long that sometimes it's like, roll for initiative. Sometimes I want to pick up a six-sided to die to roll for initiative. Yeah. It's just like, it's almost...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You're just like, okay. So, and I tell people I do that all the time. I half remember rules that don't apply.
Right.
And you're just like, okay, I got to take a
step
back.
But they're innate now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And I think that's the holdover from a lot of the games that we played as kids, is that we actually have these rules in our heads that don't actually apply to any game system, you know, that we currently play, but we actually... sort of like, hey, isn't there's rule for this? No, that's a different rule system. And we may not even remember where it's even from anymore.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, definitely, I mean, it is interesting as gamers that we had different perceptions of different groups. I actually don't think it was, you know, it's interesting that from my play experience, what happened is that you would hook up with a group that played D&D or did role-playing in some way, and usually that group usually would end up playing a whole bunch of things, you know, at some point. I mean, because I remember as a kid, I hooked up with a group that we would play Fridays, we would play Saturdays, and we would play Sunday. I mean, the weekend was nothing but games, and that was like every weekend.
Sure.
Was that way. So on Friday nights, we would play one game. On Saturday, we would play for like 12 plus hours, so we would have two different six-hour sessions. So, and then Sunday we would play for 6 hours. So between Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we would have 4 6-hour sessions. And so there would be four different games. One of them would be D&D. At least one of them would be D&D. And usually we would have two or three other things going on. You know, actually I think half of it would be D&D. 2 days would be D&D. You know, so we would have, you know, we'd be playing like the Star Trek RPG, believe it or not, from FASA, or we would be doing Gamma World, or we would try to play Top Secret, or, you know, we try to do Champions even. Champions is another game that I've always liked, but nowadays it's like, I actually don't want the hassle of it. So
sure.
I would have to say Champions definitely was another game that had a weird stigma attached to it.
Mm, I think so.
What was it?
A little too much math.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, but it was weird because, you know, when I obviously, since I'm not going to lie to people, I am, you know, 40 years old, give or take. And so, yes, when I was gaming back in the early 80s. So back then, you know, gaming was pretty much almost kind of a nerd culture kind of, I mean, more so than today, I think, you know, because whether we like to believe it or not, RPGs are a little more mainstream. You know, back then, if you played an RPG, you were definitely in that nerd category.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's expanded a little bit now.
So, we would have that going on. And it's like, okay, I'm a nerd. And so you would play with your nerd friends. And, you know, so we weren't opposed to using that calculator to do things because, well, that's what we do.
Uh-huh.
So it's just like, you know, we would be using programs to help us do stuff in gaming that would be written for the old Commodore 64. So with their single-sided discs that they would read. So you'd have a notcher to flip it over.
Nice.
I still remember that crap. So, but yeah, I mean, so there were, I mean, I guess basically there were a lot of negative things, you know, and of course for me, I think just being a gamer in general is not a good scene. Cause sometimes a lot of modern gamers, younger gamers didn't have to live through what I loosely refer to as the witch hunt period.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember. Did you ever experience that?
No, not so much. We were pretty lucky on that, but that was not really.
Yeah, that was kind of an 80s thing, believe it or not. You know, you had what is her name? She passed a while back.
Patricia Poling.
There we go.
Yeah.
You know, you had her going around talking about how dangerous Dungeons and Dragons are and how it brings you into, you know, cults and. You know, if there was anybody who was delusional, that would have been that woman, unfortunately. And you know that's about the same. You know, of course, that's when a infamous Tom Hanks movie actually was released.
Yes, that's true.
Mazes and Monsters, which
or Minotaurs. Yes, that was a big part of it.
I mean, I remember my mom watching that movie, and then she was a little scared about whether I would freak out. And it's like, no. And eventually she got over it. But that was just one of those things. But I actually remember that movie. And the funny thing is I remember somebody a long time later doing an evaluation of the movie. And they said, you know, the funny thing about the movie is that, you know, I don't feel that it's really anti-gaming. He says, because if you look at it, his friends were trying to help him. They went out looking for him. And they actually tried to help him. You know, which is a positive message because these were his good friends.
Right.
You know, and I was like, well, you know, I didn't really think about it that way. I mean, but obviously, again, it was supposed to be kind of a scare movie in many aspects. But yeah, it's just weird. It's very interesting how our perceptions of gaming have changed, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, I think a lot of it has to do with our perceptions have changed and aspects that we don't even really think about. Well, I think that about covers it for that topic. And I kind of come to pretty much the end of this show. If there's anything you'd like to tell us in the future, you can, of course, contact us through a variety of ways. You can email us at info@rpgcircus.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-643-6322. That is 1-888-643-6322. You can Twitter us at rpgcircus.com. You can contact us via Facebook at our Facebook page for RPG Circus. And remember, we also have forums at rpgtabletalk.com. That is rpgtabletalk.com. And I think that wraps it up for this episode. And it's time to pretty much strike and throw the tents. And we'll see you again. I think we'll see you again next week. The preceding podcast is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution US license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.